Hello, everyone, and welcome to Book Spider. We're a Book of the Week format podcast that sometimes remembers to come up with a clever tagline to describe itself, but other times does not. This is our third of three episodes on the Southern Reach trilogy by Jeff Vandermeer on the novel Acceptance, which is the final piece of that trilogy. Now, if you haven't already heard our first two episodes on Annihilation and Authority, then it would probably make sense to go back and listen to those, although I would imagine there'll be at least some discussion of the trilogy overall at this point, so I suppose you could just listen to this one as well if you wanted to save some time and be a little more efficient, but you know, if you want to maximize the amount of background noise while you do the dishes, then you could go ahead and start with the Annihilation episode. So we are talking about the novel Acceptance, which is the end of the trilogy. And normally this would be the point where I would read a brief synopsis of that book to reacquaint readers with the events of it, if they have not happened to read it recently, or if they're, you know, listening to it for a book report and they don't want to actually read the novel. In this particular case, because I was in transit until pretty recently, I have not written a synopsis. So I just want to see, as an experiment, if I can briefly recall the main events of the novel. And you guys can feel free to jump in if I leave anything out. One thing that I think makes this a bit different from the first two books in the series is that, you know, the events in it are twisted together from different perspectives in a much more complex way, where the first two novels are all limited to one character's perspective and mostly told in a pretty linear fashion. This is moving between several different perspectives and interweaves events that happen over a long period of time, some of which are told in a relatively obscure manner, and some of which are described by people who have only a hazy understanding of what's actually happening, right? So all those factors combine to make this certainly the most challenging of the trilogy in terms of the kind of basic task of fitting together a chronology of events. So I thought just on that level, it would be interesting to, you know, rather than cheating and writing it out ahead of time, to actually see, having just finished reading it a couple days ago, if we could put together a sequence. And I'm going to think about this in terms of each of the characters who, in terms of each of the perspective characters, right? So this might be a bit jumbled because I'm going to follow the thread of each of the perspective characters and see if we can fit together the major events of their lives as they're described in this novel. Once we have that baseline established, we can start to talk more about thematically what these mean and how we responded to this installment and to the trilogy as a whole. With me today are Chris.
Hi.
And Patrick.
Hey, what's up?
Who are the two co-hosts of the Book Spider podcast. Patrick, of course, is the author of the recently published Gusineau, which I believe we'll be doing an episode on in a couple weeks. So you have that to look forward to. And yeah. So let's see. The viewpoint character that we had at the end of the last novel, the viewpoint character from the novel Authority, was John Rodriguez, a.k.a. Control, who is a third-generation spy working in an agency called the Southern Reach, who have been tasked with investigating the phenomenon known as Area X. He's recently taken over Southern Reach at the beginning of the second book. At the beginning of this third book, the Southern Reach has begun, or sorry, Area X has begun expanding beyond its quarantine, and to the best of our awareness, is gradually overtaking the southeastern United States, probably sowing bizarre chaos, mutations, violence, at a world-ending scale. So at the end of Authority, Control, a.k.a. John Rodriguez, jumped into a portal that took him into Area X, along with Ghostbird, the Area X doppelganger of the biologist. And the two of them in this novel travel out to the island at the center of Area X. They discover the creature that the biologist from the novel Annihilation has mutated into. They read the diary of the biologist from Annihilation, and they see the kind of uncanny, massive, horrifying, monstrous kind of land, you know, living landslide of eyes that she has turned into. The section on the section containing the biologist's diary is notable, I think, because it tracks the period that she lived in between this novel and the end of Annihilation. She lives on the island. She befriends an owl that is probably a mutated version of her husband. She stays there for quite a long length of time, using physical pain to manage the transformation into a bizarre creature. Eventually, the owl dies. She finds herself alone. She gives up on managing the transformation with pain. And in the present moment of the current novel, we discover that, once again, she's turned into an enormous, bizarre monster that crushes everything in its path. Control and Ghostbird, the doppelganger, travel back to the mainland. They find the topographical anomaly, aka the underground tower, and Control travels to the bottom of the topographical anomaly. It finds something that is maybe kind of the source of Area X, just kind of like a glowing thing. Either he or Ghostbird, I can't actually remember which one has this vision, but one of the two of them has a vision of the nature of Area X that is somewhat hazily described, but as best as I can understand it, they discover that Area X was created as a kind of, a terraforming device for an alien species. Something that was meant to turn planets into something more habitable for them. But that alien species is long, long ago extinct. And the terraforming device, if I understood it correctly, was kind of encoded into a grain of sand that ended up in the lighthouse of the lighthouse tended by the character Saul Evans. Control, a.k.a. John Rodriguez, jumps into the heart of Area X and kind of dissolves himself into it, which essentially transmits his consciousness into it in a way that tames it somehow, right? Makes it less inclined to turn everything into a horrifying monstrosity. So that is, I think, the kind of present, that's the main present moment action of the novel, that sequence of events, right? And that is told from the perspectives of both Control and Ghostbird, the doppelganger of the biologist. There are also the, while this is happening, we're also getting flashbacks to Saul Evans, a.k.a. the lighthouse keeper, a.k.a. the crawler from the first novel, who, of course, is a strange beast that crawls through a tunnel inscribing Old Testament-style ramblings on a wall in glowing algae. And let's see. So we are with Saul Evans from basically from the moment that he is first infected by Area X, the glow that defines Area X, from the moment of that infection up until the period at which he kind of loses consciousness and begins his metamorphosis into the crawler. I don't know that there's too much of note to pull out from that for a synopsis, really, other than to note that, you know, the sense that we have of him from Annihilation and from the description of him in Authority suggests that maybe he's kind of a dour, I keep saying Old Testament, right? But he's described as a former preacher who writes these bizarre, vindictive Old Testament style sermons. And you get the idea that he's, you get one sense of him from that, right? But as it turns out, he's actually pretty mild and pleasant, you know, gay in a pretty active way, if not still closeted, but engaged in, actively engaged in a very, I think, functional and loving and well-portrayed queer romance, and just generally, you know, basically a pretty mellow, moderate, thoughtful kind of guy. Not really the person that he seems to be, not the person you would expect based on the historical documents that have filtered down in the first two novels. Yeah, and we see kind of a we see his gradual overtaking by what you might, I think it's called the glow. We have kind of a sidelong flash of horror as a bar is overwhelmed in chaos, and then that's his thread. And lastly, we have sections told from the perspective of the psychologist from the first book, aka Gloria. Am I remembering that right? There's Gloria and Grace, and the names are similar enough that I had a little bit of trouble sometimes. But Gloria is the psychologist slash director.
And Grace is the assistant director. So that's another...
Yes, Grace.
Another thing that's confusing.
Right, right. So Gloria, of course, grew up... well, didn't really, I don't think, grew up... I don't think she fully grew up in what would become Area X, but she was friends with the lighthouse keeper, Saul Evans, and she actually wrote the end of the novel is a letter that she has written to him from the vantage point of adulthood. And she... I'm having trouble coming up with a synopsis, actually, of Gloria's sections. But the outcome of... I mean, I think what we get out of Gloria's sections, I suppose, is just the knowledge that... or at least the strongly held theory that Area X was released by something called the Science and Seance Bureau, which was a... kind of a small collective of weirdos, for lack of a better term, that might have been, probably was, under the guidance of the Central Intelligence Agency, which John Rodriguez's mother and grandfather both worked for. So the essentially that through kind of a chain of intermediaries and... proxies that the American intelligence apparatus, either intentionally or otherwise, unleashed Area X through this group known as the Seance and Science Bureau. And I think that's it. Am I leaving out anything major that we want to have established as a baseline to talk about the novel?
There was the revelation that the island and areas of Area X undergo time dilation. So that's why the biologist was able to like live for 30 years between the end of Annihilation and now, which has presumably not been that long. And that's why Grace was on the island waiting for Ghostbird and Control for 3 years because of this random phenomena of time dilation.
There also seems to be the suggestion, actually, I forgot about this, but there seems to be the suggestion that when they are in Area X in this novel, they're actually, they've somehow been transported to an alien planet.
Oh, right, yeah.
Very far away. Even though I don't really understand how that works within the universe of the novel, even, and it kind of seems like it's tossed around a bit and abandoned. That almost felt like an editing error or vision error or something. I don't know. Maybe I'm underestimating it, but I mean, at the end of the novel, it seems like they're pretty confident that they're living on Earth, I think.
Right.
So, I don't know. I didn't really understand what was being done with that, but
right.
I think the rambling quality of that, some of the details that I was struggling to land on, those are indicative, I think, of the fact that the novel, it represents a pretty sharp departure from the first two books,
yeah.
Right? Because Annihilation, very tightly connected to the perspective of the biologist, everything in it was, to some extent, really defined by, you know, her lack of knowledge about what was happening, what things meant, defined by mystery. Authority, you know, very tightly connected to the perspective of John Rodriguez, and his lack of knowledge and understanding really was kind of one thing that defined the texture of that novel, right? The experience of discovery. And here... In the third book, we've switched to an omniscient viewpoint that pretty, well, I guess not really an omniscient narrator, right? Because there's nobody telling us what this means or what's happening. But suddenly we're jumping between perspectives in ways which completely changed the fabric of the novel, because we're no longer limited to one character's viewpoint. We're also jumping around between times quite freely, again, in contrast to the first two books, where we were mostly getting things in a pretty linear way, or in the case of Annihilation, getting flashbacks that were really just to, like, neatly organized linear set of flashbacks. So we have a much more patchwork, much more complex set of perspectives and knowledge here. So did you guys like that departure, and how did that affect your experience of the novel?
Disliked it. Made the novel worse.
I found it kind of mushy. I'm going to kind of go with Patrick here. Like, maybe I can say why mushy.
Yeah, that word mushy is pretty cool.
Well, it's just the way that Annihilation and Control play with uncertainty and confusion, sort of like abutting the desperate kind of seeking for understanding of their viewpoint characters. It works for me because of the consistency of those, of that effort, of those viewpoint characters. And I think you take that center away and it makes it mushy. It needed, for me, that center, that tension, that kind of consistent, frantic assertion from Control, and that consistent sort of like wondrous lens from the biologist. And I kind of bouncing between all of these figures, I lacked that center, and it made me frustrated.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, I would basically agree with that. And I think, like, the times that I got the most into this novel really were the periods where you had, I don't know, like, there would be sustained periods of identification with one viewpoint that I would be interested in. But the best example I can think of, actually, is the section of the section that is the biologist's journal, right? The section where she's talking about living 30 years on the island and having this relationship with this owl who may or may not be her mutated husband. And I found that passage very moving. I found it very engaging. I really connected with it in a way there that I didn't consistently with the rest of the book. And I knew it was going to end, but I was disappointed when it did, you know. I'm trying to think now why that was. I'm trying to think now why that was moving, or why that was more successful than some of the parts. I think part of it might have been because, you know, when I think like the first two novels are less about. They're less about the real kind of mechanics of what this place is and how it got to be that way, and more about the. They're less about the mechanics of what the place is and how it got to be that way, and more about the subjective experiences of people grappling with strangeness and uncertainty and this kind of very alien, exotic thing, right? And the third novel kind of does allow itself to get more interested in mechanics and the details of history and preoccupied with delivering the answers that the first two novels didn't deliver, right? And having read all this 3 or 4 years ago, I had reasonably clear memories of the first two novels, and I didn't really have any memory at all of the third novel. I remembered literally nothing about it except, well, nothing. I didn't remember anything, actually. I had the idea that none of the central questions are really resolved. And going back and rereading this, it was a little bit striking how much they actually are answered, right? It's an alien terraforming device. Oh, okay. Oh, well, you know, the future of Earth will be okay because, you know, Control jumped into the center of the tower. Oh, okay. Like, those
right.
Those things didn't stick with me at all. With 4 years vantage point, right? Like, the surreal horror of the first novel, the kind of slow, tense uncertainty of the second novel, like, those atmospheres, those sustained atmospheres of dread and uncertainty have lived in me for the years since I read this trilogy. The actual pragmatic answers of the third novel, those did not stick with me, and they probably will now because I've done a podcast about it, but I don't know. I don't feel any better about the series having learned that it kind of does have an ending and it kind of does answer the questions that it sets up. Because, again, it really was that subjectivity that made the first two novels compelling and memorable, more so than the plotting. And there's still some of that subjectivity here, and there's still kind of compelling segments and compelling viewpoints, but I'm not, yeah, I don't know. I think like the change in focus here didn't end up feeling successful to me. I wish there was someone here who were enthusiastic about this book so that I could have a defense of it, right? Like, usually, you know, one of the three of us disagrees on things like this, but I have to admit here that I think we're kind of all on the same page.
Maybe I'm gonna attempt a comparison to explain why I find this novel unsatisfying, and maybe it'll illuminate something, maybe it won't. Hans, you pointed out that this novel seems to be more concerned with answering the questions, like the world building questions that we have, whereas the first two novels are more about character studies within like disturbing or strange atmospheres. And the reason I think why I wasn't very satisfied with this novel is because I was never really here in the first two novels, I was never really here for the world building aspects. Like if I want a world building novel, there are so many other ones that are like more detailed, like just bigger worlds and bigger, like more history, things like that, that also aren't trying to fuck with my brain. Does that make sense? Like
yeah.
Vandermeer is actively trying to like make us feel strange, make us feel disturbed. And that's good. I like that. I think it makes the first two novels really interesting. But you know, when I go for a world building novel, I'll go to my favorite fantasy author, Tad Williams, who like will write these four novel series where the whole time you're asking questions about, well, why did this happen? And how's this history going to resolve? But he's never like trying to mess with your head. And at the end, he writes a novel where everything is answered and you feel really good because none of it, you weren't expecting any of it. And like, you know, you were in for that experience. Whereas I was not in for that experience this time around. And like, you're kind of like, when, you know, Control's like, oh, if I jump into the light, it'll somehow save the world. Somehow. Like, I was never in for that kind of story in the first place with Vandermeer. And two, like, it's kind of unsatisfying that there's this some kind of mysterious salvation, even though how this would save anybody and exactly why I'm concerned about everything being saved is not clear here. Whereas with a Williams novel, I'm clear on all of that. Does that make sense? Does that help at all? Or is that dumb?
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense, Patrick. I mean, I think that to your point, the part of what makes the first two novels compelling, I think, is the awareness that whether or not the characters are facing it, like this is a problem that probably can't be solved or understood.
Right.
You're actually not going to be able to break down the nature of Area X as humans. You're probably not going to be able to make it go away. The best you can really hope for is that it doesn't get worse, but then it does get worse, and we don't really even know why that is. And watching the characters process those facts is unsettling and moving and creepy and kind of feels more like how the world works.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Most of the time, almost everyone in the whole world is aware of bad things happening around them that are beyond their control to fix and probably even beyond their ability to understand. And living in the face of that, doing your best to cope with that or to, you know, take some action against it while understanding that that is maybe ultimately futile, that actually feels very, in spite of being a novel about an alien terraforming device, like that feels actually very authentic to me as a way of capturing how people live, right? And what it's like to be a person in a complicated world. Whereas in the third novel, like it's like the end of They Live, right? Like, you know, They Live, the first 80-90% of that movie is very authentic because, like, actually, you know, it feels subjectively very true to kind of suggest that we're living in a world that's controlled by things beyond our, everybody understands why They Live is powerful.
Right,
I don't need to break down why that metaphor is effective. But then at the end, when you like shoot a big satellite dish, and suddenly everything is fixed.
Right.
That's where it all breaks down. Right. But that's like, there's a certain vein of science fiction or, you know, story generally where an author does such a good job of creating a problem so big that it's impossible to imagine how it could be fixed.
Right.
Or creating a dilemma so bad that it's impossible to imagine how it could be resolved. And rather than actually commit to allowing the bigness of that to kind of overwhelm the characters in the world, at the end you shoot a satellite dish, right? And it's like, it was very strange to me that we crammed in a shooting the satellite dish ending in this novel. If I'm understanding what happens correctly, which I think that I am. The same thing goes for understanding the nature of Area X, right? Like, oh, somebody happens to have it psychically fed to her in a vision. Like, oh, all right, well, yeah, like it undermines, I think, like having the problems be solvable and the answers explicable undermines a lot of what was powerful about the construction of the first two books. Now, I don't know how I would have done it differently, really, right? Like, I don't know if I were Jeff Vandermeer, I don't know how I would come to what felt like a satisfying resolution. I do feel like the letter at the end, the letter from Gloria to Saul, like that suggests, I liked that. I liked that device, and I liked that. I mean, what that letter is really about is like finding meaning in human connection in the face of these inexplicable, unsolvable things. And there's a beauty and a grace in that that I think is good and that feels more like what I would want an ideal version of this novel to bring across. Sorry, go ahead, Petra.
Oh, I don't know if it's that important. You said, I don't know how I would have fixed it. And I was going to describe how I would have written it, but that's probably not that important.
No, go ahead.
I think I would have introduced a new character in Area X, tried to come up with a different arc from the first one, and to give closure to the first two novels, I would incorporate the diary that we have from the biologist, and then have this third new character discover some document or something that tells us how Control and Grace and Ghostbird meet their fates as well. So maybe something like that, so that we could stay close to a character again, develop the theme of strangeness, but still get some closure for the first two novels. Maybe that's how I would do it. I don't know.
I it's funny. I was thinking about this too while reading it. Like, I actually had a very, I didn't think about how I would write it differently. I thought about how, well, a little bit of that, but how I would edit it. And I really just, first going back to the letter at the end, and I'm sorry to jump to the last question that you gave us, Hans. You asked us, like, what about the title? And the letter at the end, there's this passage, you can get caught up in something that's beyond you and never understand why. The world we are a part of is difficult to accept, unimaginably difficult. I don't know if I accept everything even now. I don't know how I can, but acceptance moves past denial, and maybe there's defiance in that too. And I really like that. Like, that's a really interesting, like, acceptance not being passive, but actually being a kind of an act of bravery and even defiance, and something that is actually a step further, that acceptance is an act of participation that shouldn't be discounted. And I really like that. And I feel like that's at odds with parts of the book that you've already described, Hans. Like, it doesn't seem like the book is willing to commit to that as much as I really would want it to. And in my mind, I think, like, I think that, like, for me, I really was enjoying time with Saul, and I really was enjoying time with the director, just as a complicating viewpoint, a complicating sort of like perspective or angle on her character, considering our impressions of her from Annihilation and from Control. And I thought, you know, I don't really know if I need the other characters as much. I don't need Control anymore. I don't need Ghostbird. I don't even really want their narratives wrapped up. Maybe without having that, I would miss it. But like, it occurred to me to think that, like, Patrick, how I would do this novel differently, or how I would advise Vandermeer. Like, I don't want to Vandermeer is a great writer. Yeah, like he's a very, very good writer. And so, like, if I were a reader or an editor, and he was asking my thoughts, those would be the thoughts that I would give him.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, thinking about, I like your point about acceptance, and I do completely agree that the theme of it feels a bit undermined by some of the tidiness of the novel, right? Some of the tidiness of the ending undercuts the work that parts of the rest of the novel do to advance that idea. I mean, I guess, you know, if somebody were here who were a fan of the novel, or if Jeff Vandermeer were here, like, they might point out that we don't have any idea how much Area X has already transformed the world, right? Like, it might very well be that the whole entire world is now Area X, right? Like, or that, you know, a large portion of the United States is now Area X. It's not like Control flips a, it's not like Control jumping into the center of it, you know, creates some kind of, it's not like it hits some kind of magical reset button where suddenly things are back to how they were before it all began. Like, there has still been a huge amount of bad stuff, and nothing is ever going to be the same. And there is still room for acceptance there, definitely.
I just loved it set it up, and I'll stop at this point, but early in acceptance, we get from the former director psychologist, from Gloria's perspective, an idea from Whitby, a list of elements that you would use to define what Area X is, conditions required for Area X to exist, including an isolated place, an inert but volatile trigger, a catalyst to pull the trigger, an element of luck or chance in how the trigger was deployed, a context we do not understand, an attitude toward energy that we do not understand, an approach to language that we do not understand. And that is put there early on as like a kind of an attempt to put Area X into a schema or to a kind of taxonomy for understanding Area X. And I just really liked that attempt, and I was very sad to see some of those answered. I wish that was just like, it was just laid out there as like something that we do to try and like, to try to understand the world around us, but that, you know, it feels like it contradicts Area X itself and what makes it interesting.
I remember when we started the Annihilation episode, I mentioned that I had been talking to a friend who had recommended these books to me back when they first came out, and I asked him what the theme was, and he said the theme was there are some things you'll never understand. And at the time, I was very dismissive of that as a way of getting across the idea of the book, right? But I wish now that he had been more correct.
Because it's not just that. I mean, like, I'm actually coming out of this, I think that I really thought that I hated the second book, and really am the first time that I read it, and now coming through these a second time, I think I might even like Control better than Annihilation. And
second one's the best.
Yeah, the second one's great. I mean, and it isn't just about, you know, there are things that we won't understand. That's not really that interesting. But what is interesting is to show the disintegration of a bureaucratic system against that, and the people who comprise that system and their senses of identity that are derived from the roles that they play in that system, and to see how all of that sort of falls apart in a way that is sort of it's really compelling and interest. That's an interesting thing. And I don't know that, like, Vandermeer was trying to do the same thing with the third book.
Yeah, I don't know. And it might be, I was going to ask about how your perspective had shifted, Chris, actually, because you and I had both read this trilogy and regarded it as underwhelming beyond the first book. And I was going to ask how your feeling about the whole thing had shifted, and you've told me how it shifted. And it's entirely possible that if I were to come back to this in 5 more years, I would actually appreciate what's going on here, maybe much more so, right? In some way, you know, that there might be something to it that I'm not getting now, and that maybe kind of I could see then. Or that the other side of it is that I do wonder if maybe, you know, one of the questions I sent us ahead of time had to do with sentimentality, right? By which I meant, that's kind of a word with a negative valence to it, and I think I meant for it to have that. But the first two books are so kind of chilly and alienated. And, you know, in Annihilation, there's something really moving about the biologists, the way that she kind of comes to some slight sense of greater connection with her husband, the way that she comes to understand maybe levels of depth in him that she didn't previously see. But that's relatively, there's not a lot of that. It's not a big transformation, and it happens near the end of the novel, right? And that's fine. I didn't want there to be more of that. I mean, I think it's, you know, when you have a great big whopping lot of minor chords, then a little bit of major tonality really sticks out, right? I liked that about it. But you know, like, the ways in which those human relationships that are hinted at in the first two novels are allowed to develop in more significant ways here, right? Like the relationship she has with the owl, which seems like an extension of her kind of coming to terms with fondness for her husband, right? Like the whole sequence, or the final page with the letter from Gloria to Saul, or, you know, Saul and Charlie's relationship. Like, there's a way that this novel is interested in warm human connection that those things are kind of more naked here than they were in the first two novels. And it may be that that's what I remember about this in a few years, and I remember those things fondly because the less compelling aspects of this have fallen away a bit. I had a question here about some of the themes that we talked about a little in relationship to the first two novels. The way that I formed the question was to ask whether any of these themes had really been developed or advanced here, but if they haven't been, then that might be kind of its own indictment of how this third book is working, I guess. But we've talked to a greater or lesser extent about how this series overall in the first two books portrayed governmental authority. Is there anything here that deepens that critique or that advances that in any way? I'll take your silence as a negative.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking, like, you know, the idea that the CIA has kind of primed the Seance and Science Brigade to kind of unleash this terraformer or activate this terraformer or whatever, is another, like, token of the kind of critique that authority already raised. But I don't know that, does it deepen it or extend it? Or, I don't know, it just seems to provide another example of of how authority can be pretty heinous.
Right.
Right.
Well, and it's such a passing thread, you know.
Right. Right. Exactly.
If it were to explore how Lowry's involvement is actively, and I think that maybe, like, I can't tell if Lowry, it doesn't seem like Lowry is actively trying to engender impotence into the Southern Reach as a way, like, basically, is it all just a kind of catch 22, like, gesture toward investigating something when there's nothing to investigate, or, you know, and it feels like, I didn't come away with a sense that like there was anything that the novel was doing to use that complication in, you know, in a way that explores the themes of authority, where, you know, Southern Reach is basically dissolving in a kind of hopeless soup. And there is this pressure from Lowry as, you know, a kind of unseen operative steering control to do something there. And, you know, does acceptance answer any of that or complicate any of that? I didn't come away with a good sense for what those answers or those complications would be. And I would have liked to have that.
It's interesting because this is somehow both very obscure and overly revelatory at the same time, this book overall, right? Like,
yeah.
I mean, I complained at the beginning that it was hard to put a synopsis together. And then I complained after doing the synopsis that it gave us too many answers. And I don't think that those are necessarily mutually exclusive at all, right? It's just kind of characteristic of it that it's obscure for a long period of time, and then it goes, oh, hey, here's the answers. And then that's kind of the arc of discovery, right? And, you know, you've been haltingly trying to kind of lay out a framework for how to think about what Lowry does, or, you know, what it is that Jack and Jackie Severance really did. And I mean, I think that the obscurity of all that and the ways in which all of it is tentatively theorized by characters really is an impediment to kind of advancing any of the critique of governmental authority, right? As opposed to if we had just, like, there's no reason that we can't have Lowry as a viewpoint character. There's no reason we can't have Jackie Severance as a viewpoint character, because, Christ, we've got everybody else as a viewpoint character, you know?
But, you know, going back to Patrick's earlier comment about lore, like, basically, like, is this, like, I don't, the kind of inconsistency of mutations of facts and figures and elements of Area X sort of invites us from in the first two novels into a space where we're just not really, like, there for, like, a taxonomy of this space. Basically, like, we're there for it's more a vibe, right? Like, it's like this is kind of an ambient drone album.
Right.
And then the third novel, it does feel like there is this effort to kind of create that sense of lore. And I think what the issue is that, like, the driving, like, the energy of the first two novels is derived from a completely different source, and it doesn't seem to bridge into the third novel, and maybe, like, it's funny, like, the third novel standing on its own might be a completely different thing from, you know, being the closing book in a trilogy, where the first two books have this peculiar dynamo at the center of them that's mostly from, again, this like tension between subjectivity and an unreconcilable mystery, and you jump out of that and you jump into like answers more or less, and you kind of lose that.
Well, that kind of feels like the last word on the novel,
actually. Sure. I know. It's really, Vandermeer's great. I love Vandermeer. And I mean,
but
I can't
fucking sucks.
Write these books. No, it doesn't suck. I can't write these books. They're gifts to be so good to read, but
this one's not a gift. This one's just a messy plate.
It's a messy plate that does contain some really good things.
I agree with that.
Well, I'll say, like, Vandermeer can write like a Lovecraftian scene. Or I say Lovecraftian, but I don't think I've read actually very much Lovecraft, so that's more like understanding by proxy what Lovecraftian is. But like the bar scene that you talked about in the summary that you gave at the beginning is awesome. Like when Saul watches as like the people around him start to devolve is the wrong way of putting it. But everything sort of breaks down, language breaks down, people's voice, the one person's voice is coming out of another person's body. They're like, you know, twitching and, you know, blood's gushing out of a guy's fingers because he's playing the piano so hard. Like that kind of shit, you know, that's awesome. And all the slow burn to get to something like that is pretty cool.
And I mean, I think if this episode has a negative tone to it, a lot of that does come from being very fond of the first two books, right? Like if I read this in a vacuum, and you could almost read this without, I mean, it might be more interesting in a way to read this without having read the first two books, right? But like, if I were to read this in a vacuum, it might be that the aspects that are interesting and appealing would be more, would be a greater part of the melange that I came away with. I don't know.
But you can't do that until somebody creates the selective memory forgetting button.
Right, right. And I will still, you know, when Absolution comes out in October, I'll still read that and I'll probably pick it for the podcast. So
yeah,
I'm not off the series or off Vandermeer. And yeah, there is a lot that I liked and admired about this. It was just presented in a way that didn't do it. The best parts are not done justice by the overall structure. So, 2 weeks from now, Patrick, we're talking about Gusano featuring special guest Eddie Kim. Am I remembering that scheduling?
Yeah, I think so. Like, Chris, last time we talked, you said, let's do it. And then Hans, you said, let's invite Eddie. So I contacted him and scheduled it.
Awesome. I love Eddie.
Very, very good. All right, well, loyal listeners, tune in 2 weeks for a discussion with our co-host Patrick Barney about his novel Gusano. And if you have not read Gusano, be sure to do so in the next 2 weeks, because I anticipate a spoiler-heavy discussion, because what spurred my interest in actually talking about the book at length was, in fact, the ending. So to the extent that I have any control over the content or direction of that episode, I plan to be starting at the end, because I think it unlocks a lot of what thematically the whole book is trying to say. So you have 2 weeks to read it, and I'd advise you to fucking get on the horn. That's not what it means to get on the horn, is it? Get on the ball, rather. All right. Nice talking to you guys. This has been the Book Spider Podcast.
Thank you, guys.